Good evening. I see a lot of new and newer faces tonight. Welcome. And this would be a good opportunity to invite newer people to our monthly introduction to Buddhism and Zazen, which happens to be in a couple of days, Saturday from 10 to noon, completely free. And I believe Edie will be teaching the class. And that's a good way to familiarize oneself with some of the meditation postures and thoughts on meditation that we use here at Zen Center. We go over some of the bows and rituals that we use, that we do here, and a little discussion on some key Dharma points. So it's we do this the fourth Saturday of each month. So if this isn't a good month, put it on your calendar for another month, but it's a good way to get a little more comfortable with some of the traditions here at Santa Cruz Zen Center. I'll keep going with talking about devotional practice that we're looking at this year. Oh. In the last few lectures, we've looked at bowing. And why we bow, what we bow to. Zen is known for its just sitting. In fact, we're the just sitting school of Buddhism. But we do an awful lot of rituals. We do an awful lot of bowing. We do an awful lot of chanting and ceremonies. It's our family way. Just up the street, the Vipassana group is a little different. They certainly do sitting there at the front of their sitting hall is a table with a pot of flowers on it. There's no altar or statues. And they don't do much chanting or bowing or ceremonies. It's a different style. And certainly the Dharma of Shakyamuni Buddha is taught vigorously there. Up the highway a little bit in Corralitos is the Pema Osaling Tibetan Buddhism Center, where they have a 16-foot golden Buddha, probably as long as that wall, longer than 16 feet. And that's just one of the many altars in that big meditation hall. And there's hundreds of oil lamps all around, and it's quite a devotional practice among the practitioners there to kind of clean and tidy up the altar for several hours every day. It's filled with, in addition to the many Buddhas, there's other bodhisattvas and deities around the room. Small little figurines made out of a bread dough that's lacquered and painted all get dusted daily in a ritualistic way. So we have quite a variety of ways to awaken with all beings, to face unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. Let's take a look at you know, why we do any of this, why we come here and sit for 40 minutes, why we do walking meditation, why we do bowing and chanting. Those who are looking for a spiritual life are nurtured by practicing and seeking the way, or seeking salvation, or seeking liberation, or seeking you know, what is reality, what is this, who am I? These are kind of traditional seeker questions that bring us into some kind of practice. And maybe we were first drawn to this, maybe we got an inkling of this by some experience that we had in nature on a hike, or maybe it was an interpersonal relationship that made us feel part of this big human family. Or maybe it was our own suffering that made us want to have another kind of perspective on what is life. But we're drawn to a practice such as this. We turn towards such a practice, the practice pulls us in, and many of us feel like there's a coming home quality. We actually in Buddhism talk about taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, taking refuge in this place, coming flying back to our true home. I think this spiritual search is always connected to our heart. It's a heart and compassion practice. We're led here by our heart. And most traditions tend to access this kind of bigger, spacious, spiritual side of life by dropping our usual ego and self and our habitual thoughts. We kind of put down our everyday life and turn to this more open, expansive environment of maybe ourselves that allows us that bigger perspective on true reality, or who am I, or just this is it. So with a heartfelt, expansive environment. In Zen practice, most of us were here for the 40-minute sit. We kind of face the wall. We minimize distraction. our mind gets quieter. We're not holding on to our usual thoughts so tightly, but as they arise, we let them go and then come back to our quiet sitting. Dogen, one of our, or the founder of our school of Zen in Japan in the 1200s, said that we drop body and mind when we're sitting in this zazen, in our sitting meditation. We drop those usual patterns of thinking, the repetitive habits that we get into when we think about this or that. We let them go so that we might feel closer, or we might feel without that, the confines of our usual thoughts and usual way of holding our body, that we exist in that more expansive, heartfelt place with the broader view, with the wider perspective on the nature of reality. Another Zen teacher, a modern Zen teacher, Uchiyama Roshi. I picked up his book. It's been around for 40 years, not in my possession, but this book, Opening the Hand of Thought. He had that great the great image of usually we hold on pretty tightly to our ideas and opinions. And in this meditation, in seated meditation, Zazen, we open that tight grip. We open the hand of our usual thinking patterns and just let those thoughts drift away like clouds through an open sky. That was his description of this meditation. He goes into a little more detail here. I've written down a lot of page numbers, but I didn't bring my glasses, so I'm just going to have to make it up.
You want some reading glasses?
Well, they're just in my pocket in the closet back there. So if I really wanted them, I'll see what I can do. He says, however, to throw out thought and not tie one phenomena to another continues being prior to thought. He says that when we let our thoughts go, when we quiet our mind, we're actually dwelling, abiding. Ooh, here comes some glasses.
Why not, man?
I know. thank you very much. It's probably to reduce your suffering as much as mine. Then the lecture will go a lot faster now. Oh yeah. Without these thoughts, quieting down those thoughts, letting those thoughts go, stopping those thoughts, we're abiding in the time before we divide the world up into this and that. He says connecting one phenomena to another constitutes being prior to thought, before thought occurs. Hence, it is before the separation of things into this and that. When we are practicing Zazen, we exist before separating this moment from eternity. or from before separating subject from object. I like that image. We've got all eternity here, right with us. We're in a sea of eternity, and when we, and our mind picks out just this moment to separate from the rest of eternity and says, this is me, this is Patrick, this is Patrick's moment right now, and a breath later, I'm going to pluck out another moment, and this is, I just like that, out of all eternity, we, this mind, plucks out one moment after another and says, this is mine. Uchiyama says, when we let go of thoughts, we're throwing out our arrogance. This is a translation, and maybe that's not the best word, arrogance, but what it means is every thought we have belongs to this separate self. Each thought separates us out from the rest of the universe. And this zazen, this meditation practice where we quiet those thoughts and we exist before we exist prior to thought and prior to separating everything out. When everything is just right now, this is what we do in our meditation. Everything is unified and one and expansive, both in time. All of time is right here, and all of space is right here. We haven't separated things out into this and that, this side of the Zendo, that side of the Zendo, you or me. There's that undivided intimacy with, it's just undivided. There's no intimacy with. It is just undivided. And this is the large perspective that everything is undivided and connected. I think we can also have devotional practice, our chanting and bowing and rituals and ceremonies, with the same undivided mind. We've been studying the Lotus Sutra, which talks a lot about devotion. And the Lotus Sutra was very important to Soto Zen practice. It's cited most, it's the most often citation in Dogen's 95 fascicles, his great work, Shobogenzo. Dogen, before he learned this just sitting school of Buddhism from his travels to China, he was a Tendai monk. The Tendai school of Buddhism studied the Lotus Sutra almost exclusively. So Dogen was started his Buddhist studies and his Buddhist meditation with the Lotus Sutra in mind, and probably gave the just sitting school that he learned in China, he gave it maybe the flavor. He added the flavor of the Lotus Sutra to this just sitting school. But the Lotus Sutra At some point, Buddha is chanting the Lotus Sutra, and this huge stupa, this tower, this kind of empire state building of a tower, shoots out of the earth and actually then comes floating into the air. And there's another Buddha inside of it. Usually stupas, you know, are places that people go to chant and bow, venerate the Buddha. Sometimes it has relics of Buddhas or ancestors in it. But a lot of the times they're just these remarkable towers that people circumambulate and bow and light incense in front of it. And this one that popped up in the middle of Buddha's lecture on the Lotus Sutra, or Buddha teaching the Lotus Sutra, this one had another Buddha inside it from past eons, the Abundant Treasures Buddha. And when it appeared, the Buddha himself went and shared the seat, like the head student with me here, went and sat down next to the Buddha Abundant Treasures. So here was this stupa with two Buddhas in it. And it starts giving us a little clue on how we should look at objects that we venerate. Our little 1 foot tall Buddha back there, that we bow and chant in front of every day. The Buddha actually is showing us that, inside even the smallest stupas, none other than the Buddhas themselves. The Buddhas dwell in these stupas of veneration, is the lesson that the Lotus Sutra gives us with this example. Earlier in the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha starts predicting, making predictions for all of the many myriads and what's the term, thousands and myriads and billions of beings that have gathered around listening to the Lotus Sutra. First he predicts for his closest disciples that have been with him for 40 years that they are going to be Buddhas and have their own Buddha lands. And over the course of the next few chapters, it turns out that all these thousands and myriads and billions of followers are each given their own Buddha land. And Buddha says that actually that's what I'm here to preach, is my true teaching is that there's just I teach the one Buddha vehicle, that this practice, in those days, this practice leads us all to be being a Buddha. This Lotus Sutra then fits in nicely with the other literature that was appearing in those days, around the year, around the time of Christ in the year zero, the first century BC and CE, the Buddha nature literature that said that in those sutras the Buddha says we all have Buddha nature. I'm the Buddha, and you all have the nature to become the Buddha in you. You've got a little bit of my style, a little bit of my life, and maybe there's that little bit of me in all of you that will grow and expand until you are the Buddha in your own Buddha land. As a matter of fact, at the time that this stupa rises up, also emanations of the Buddha from other Buddha lands. You know, what are emanations? Like reflections, like in a house of mirrors, maybe. You know, if anybody has a good definition, but the sutra says emanations of the Shakyamuni Buddha that was giving the lecture. All these emanations were also at the same time preaching the Lotus Sutra. The Buddha gathers these emanations that I think were pieces of him. To this site with the abundant treasures Buddha in the sutra. So we're getting this picture that everything contains a piece of everything else, that everything is already pretty intimate with pieces of the Buddha here, pieces of the Buddha there. That there's not much separation, that it's a pretty tight family already, that this idea of undividedness and intimacy is kind of the nature of the teaching. He says that studying the Lotus Sutra or just reciting a few words of the Lotus Sutra brings up, I'll be there, I'll come back. I'll come back for any recitation of the Lotus Sutra. So the very Lotus Sutra itself, the very book, is associated with the Buddha being there, right here and right now. The Diamond Sutra, which appeared just before the Lotus Sutra, boldly says, "This looks like a book, but it's really the body of Buddha." So all of a sudden, all these things, like stupas or Buddha statues, or books containing the words of the sutra, all the people around you that you see, are all intimate, undivided Buddhas. Everything, even though there's another teaching about there's nothing holy, everything starts looking pretty holy, or at least worthy of our hearts being open to. In the Lotus Sutra, one chapter of the Lotus Sutra is called The Lifespan of the Buddha, where Buddha says that, for the benefit of by this time, the very small number of his students that he's been teaching in his 40 years on Earth, he tells them, you know, actually, I've been here forever. There's never been a time. There's been no beginning when I started. I've been here forever, and there'll be no. And I'll be here twice as long as that. There'll be no end. So all of a sudden, in space and time, just in the same way that Uchiyama says, in our Zazen, we abide in timelessness and spacelessness, or more accurately, in the eternity of time and in the boundless space. Buddha was showing people that this is actually our true home, boundless space, beginningless and endless time. This is our true home, and this is what we get a little picture of in our Zazen. And This is what I think Dogen wanted us to practice with the rituals and ceremonies of our school, with our chanting, with our bowing, looking at that small Buddha and having that same intimacy. Oh, the Buddha is right there. There's no separation. As a matter of fact, I know that it's my Buddha nature that's brought me here to this Zen center today. It's my Buddha nature. It's that same thing that I share with that Buddha on the altar that has me put my hands in gassho and bow to my cushion and bow to the Sangha before I sit down. Dogen takes it from there in the Shobogenzo and talks a lot about the Buddha being in all things. Remember, it's our small self, it's our egos that divide the world up into this and that. And in that abiding before thought separates everything, we are just one Buddha. Uchiyama Roshi in this book says that Zazen itself, you know, with its undivided intimate practice, excuse me, is Buddha itself. We chant. We chant the Bendawa, the on the endeavor of the way, a section of it. One day, one morning each week, where Dogen talks about the things of the universe. Grasses, trees, and lands that are embraced by this way of transformation together radiate a great light and endlessly expound the inconceivable profound Dharma. Grass, trees, and walls bring forth the teaching to all beings, including common people and sages. So these, Dogen is reminding us that the grass, trees, lands, walls, tiles, and pebbles are teaching us the Dharma all the time. They teach us, they teach sages, they teach others that in the undivided, intimate abiding where we dwell, it's all Buddha. It's all teaching. Buddha, Dogen has another chapter called The Power of the Robe, where he gives, he talks about the special powers of the robes that monks wear. Wei Ning was the sixth ancestor in China. I guess this is probably about, maybe 600 or 700 CE, is when Wei Ning was alive. Wei Ning received a robe from Hong Gren at Mount Wangmei and maintained it for the rest of his life. This robe is still enshrined at the Baolin Monastery in Mount Kaoshi, where he taught. There's a few paragraphs that say how this robe is displayed around China and always very ceremoniously brought back to its home monastery. Then Dogen says, there is more merit in seeing the Buddha robe, hearing the teachings of it, and making offerings to it than in presiding over a billion worlds. He says, you have more merit or more good fortune by just seeing the robe, listening to what the robe is teaching, than if you were a monarch of a billion kingdoms. Oh, I wanted to go on this page. The robe has been called the garment of emancipation. The hindrances and actions and defilements and the effects of unwholesome actions are all removed by it. If a dragon obtains a small piece of the robe, it can be cured of febrile diseases. If an ox touches a robe with one of its horns, its past wrongdoings will disappear. There's a chapter in the Lotus Sutra where reaching out and thinking of the Bodhisattva of compassion, Kuan Yin Avalokiteshvara, cures you from illnesses or plucks you out of prison or gets you out of tight spot. So there's that, it seems like magic in this conventional world that we live in, but in a world where everything is one, where everything is intimate, remembering this heartfelt, expansive place we're in relieves us of this suffering, and that's what our well-being practices, even today, in the chanting this morning, we chanted for a relative of a Sangha member who's ill, and we chanted to Kuan Yin Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of great compassion, to make us more compassionate so that we can be caregivers and support for someone who might need us, like this relative of a Sangha member. Another example is in the other book. Another fascicle by Dogen called Tathagata's Entire Body. By Sajya Raja, is another bodhisattva with a long name. Whenever a sutra is expounded, read, chanted, copied, or kept, a seven treasure stupa, tall, wide, and solemn, is erected. But do not enshrine the Buddha's relic in it. Shakyamuni is telling this bodhisattva there on Vulture Peak about erecting stupas. Whenever a sutra is read, erect a seven treasure stupa, but don't put a Buddha's relics in it. The reason is that a stupa already embodies the Tathagata's entire body. Make offerings of all sorts of flowers, incense, jewels, canopies, banners, music, and chanting verses of respect to the stupa. When people see the stupa, bow and make offerings. When they bow and make offerings to it, they know that they are closer to unsurpassable, complete, perfect enlightenment. He goes on to say, this being so, a sutra is the Tathagata's entire body. To bow to a sutra is to bow to the Tathagata's entire body. To encounter a sutra is to encounter the Tathagata's entire body. A sutra is the relics of the Tathagata. So the relics of the Tathagata are a sutra. Even if you know that a sutra is the relics, if you don't know that the relics of the Tathagata are a sutra, that's not the Buddha way. The reality of all things right now is a sutra. Just this, this undivided, intimate abiding are the very words of the Tathagata, a sutra. Sutras are the very words that the Tathagata said, that the Buddha said. He's saying that just this meditation where we abide before dividing the world up, where we divide in intimacy, are the Buddha's words. Just that non-separation between my Buddha nature and the Tathagata's body in the stupa on the altar, just that non-separation and intimacy are the very words of the Buddha. And this is a pretty close reflection from the early teaching of the Lotus Sutra. It makes its way into, 1,000 years later, into the teaching of Dogen, the founder of our school, and with all the bows that we do, with the ceremonies, with the chants, with the rituals, this intimacy with all things, this non-separation of all things, and this heartfelt connection with all things has made its way into our practice. Maybe a few of you have had some experiences with our ritual of sitting and our chanting and bowing ceremonies that feel like intimacy and non-separation. Maybe you'd like to bring up those experiences. There's this huge temple in Orange County, Shai Lai Temple. It also is a Buddhist university. But you walk through several huge temples with lots of Buddhas and deities and bodhisattvas before making your way to the main temple. And people go there on Sundays and spend the day there. And in front of each of these buildings and along this kind of pilgrimage that lasts, or that is the length of about a city block, you know, going from from temple to temple before you hit the main temple. There's huge pots of charcoal and lots of incense, and people take incense and stop and in a kind of very private moment, even though there's thousands and myriads and billions of people there for the day, in a private, intimate moment, one by one, they plant this incense and either do a standing bow or a full prostration before going into the temple and onto the next temple and onto the next incenser with more incense and more charcoal. So I think throughout Buddhism, we in most of the traditions of that have come to us from the East, we have the opportunity for this intimate practice of venerating the Buddhas. Yes.
In relation to the ceremonies that we do here, when I first came to Zazen, it seemed very strange to me. And I felt very separate from them, and I was anxious about even becoming close to them. I had questions about cultural appropriation and other sort of concerns, like what am I doing if I participate in this ceremony that I perceive to be someone else's? And then as I began to participate, I think I got stuck in the Zendo one day and didn't leave in time, and then I had the chance to do this thing. And I later began to appreciate and understand the ceremonies are something that we help each other with. And I saw the intimacy in the ceremony as being the way that the ceremonies are complicated. They're very short and they're simple in some ways, but they're very complicated in other ways. And we're always helping each other with those ceremonies. And so it really, that part of the practice of helping each other just try to do it together really came through to me after a while. And I began to see that the ceremony is something that's being created by the doing of it and the sharing of it, rather than something that's being appropriated from some other place outside. It's being created right here.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, actually, that over time, When you ask about the ways in which we have the experience of the intimacy in it, I began to experience the intimacy of the practice of helping one another with practice in trying to figure out how to do these ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
And thus I continue to appreciate that.
Yes. Yeah, Kokyo calls them art pieces, kind of performance art. To really kind of underline your word of, you know, we create them together, and that and they can be very creative, even though most of them are, we do the same way over and over. Sometimes we get pretty creative, but you're right. The doing of them is definitely a group project where we're really trying to do it together and create this environment together. And
I'll add one more observation. That when I went to Tassajara, I'm always impressed by the and its city center and other places too. Their ceremonies are very tightly orchestrated. They work very, very smoothly. They appear to me to be working very smoothly and seamlessly. And here I feel more like we're a garage band. Kind of just doing it, and everybody's very, it's very participatory, and it's always a little different every time we perform.
Yes, we are. David Chadwick said there's a lot of Zen centers, and he looked around and said, "This is a Zen corner." we're like a Zen garage band playing in our little corner. Kathy.
Well, I had another thing I wanted to say, but I want to comment on what you just said, Dean. I do love that we do have a broad band practice, but I also want to say that we can also do really high church. I mean, when we produced the mountain seat ceremony for Catherine's becoming an abbot many years ago, I really had a feeling of, you know, we may be kind of small and humble, but, you know, we had guests from Japan. Suzuki Roshi's son was here and named our temple. And Reb was impressed. So we have that capacity to, you know, to really do that more elaborate. I was going to say that I didn't answer your question at first because I was wondering what your thought is about devotional practice not in Zendo and not with the stupas and the Buddha figures, but with the natural world. Because I had an experience yesterday of that, and I'm wondering, do you think that's inappropriate?
Monterey Bay Zen Center, our kissing cousin just down the coast, has a very nice altar, but on its altar is not a recognizable Buddha shape, but a, you know, large stone, and I think, you know, as I said in the beginning, some of the experiences that we have in nature where we really get this expansive feeling that I'm not separate from this. You know, this isn't a beautiful scene over there that I'm experiencing over here. But we get that experience of being totally intimate with that great wild nature. And so I think our practice is very much informed by the natural life.
I had the experience, I went to the Pinnacles, and I just want to recommend that right now. It is just an absolutely beautiful place to be.
Yeah.
And I did this very intentional, like, devotional practice where I had some sage to offer. And I walked, and every time I noticed that my mind was getting small, and that, you know, we had that conversation about Tempest and the Teapot, every time my thoughts my hand thought was tight on something, I stopped, and I looked around, and I didn't walk again until my mind had just really opened to, you know, and in fact, I even said out loud, like, what do I actually see right now? And I would just name what was there, you know, the yellow flower, the moss on the rock. And after four or five noticings, I would realize, okay, I'm actually not thinking about that thing anymore. And then I would offer and thank whatever, the flower or the rock, for helping me. You know, and I think about that with that Lotus Sutra. You know, the traditional story, you ask Avalokiteshvara for help. But I don't think it's that different. I think that we use different images and different, you know, like maybe for some people statues and things like that. But I think that the rocks and the flowers and the animals can really help us to open.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're so, it's so obviously that there's this big world that's outside of us. But if we just open our eyes and look at it and let it in, it's really hard to keep, it's really stupid. You realize how stupid it is to keep focused on this little tiny, tight thing when there's all this abundance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, when you're actually that abundance itself, we ask ourselves, how come I'm so caught up in, you know, this or that when I'm really part of this huge great thing. I mean, the Pinnacles are so great. I mean, they look like big stupas, all those tall pointy things.
Yeah.
But even, you know, even at home, we can take on, you know, our mindfulness practices are like devotional practices. You know, just when we take the time to hold our coffee cup with both hands so that we're really connected to it and we feel its weight, and there's less separation between, you know, this old coffee cup and me. It becomes more intimate with me. Just those smaller devotional practices show us that world before we divide it up into small little chunks. So we can do these devotional practices over and over again. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about devotion while driving, you know, really being grateful that I've got a car, you know, I can go any place. I want to do it mindfully. I want to do it, you know, with my heart and not just, you know, unthinkingly. So we can apply this intimate indivisibility practice wherever we go. It's a nice evening. Maybe we can have tea outside on the patio, and we can talk more about this practice, whether it's on the cushion or whether it's looking into the eyes of our stupa here and saying, I'm connected with you. Thank you very much. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Unsurpassable, I vow to become it.